This poem is by Danish filmmaker Hagen Hasselbalch. Let there be peace, welfare, and righteousness in every part of the world. Let confidence and friendship prevail for the good of the East and West and for the good of the needy South, for the good of all humanity. Let the people inspire their leaders, helping them to seek peace by peaceful means, helping them and urging them to build a better world. A world with a home for everybody, a world with food and work for everybody, a world with spiritual freedom for everybody. Let those who have the power of money be motivated by selfless compassion. Let money become a tool for the good of humankind. Let those who have power deal respectfully with the resources of the planet. Let them respect and maintain the purity of the air, water, land, and subsoil. Let them cooperate to restore the ecological soundness of Mother Earth. Let trees grow up by the billions around the world. Let green life invade the deserts. Let industry serve humanity and produce waste that serves nature. Let technology respect the holiness of Mother Earth. Let those who control the mass media contribute to create mutual understanding, contribute to create optimism and confidence. Let ordinary people meet by the millions across the borders. Let them create a universal network of love and friendship. Let billions of human beings cooperate to create a good future for their children and grandchildren. Let us survive in peace and harmony with Mother Earth.
Thank you, Brian. So I watch people paying close attention to the story of the Lorax. It's going to be hard for my sermon to follow that. That's like good stuff. How do you argue with that? And I don't mean to argue, but how do you make it, how do you grapple with the reality of the world we live in? Because we do cut down, what kind of trees are those? I don't know. Truffle trees, right? We do cut down truffle trees, and we do use them to build our homes. Anyway, the sermon title that I put into the newsletter was chosen before I realized this was Earth Day. And that maybe says something about my own sense of priorities. I'm human and fallible. Given all the environmental crises that we face, and given the spiritual connection that we all feel with nature and with ecological systems and this beautiful blue-green planet, how does one forget Earth Day? It occurs on the 22nd of April every year. And it has since 1970 in the United States and 1980 in Canada. And according to Wikipedia, Earth Day events are happening in more than 193 countries now around the world, coordinated globally by the Earth Day Network. But you can thank Deborah for getting me back on track for this service. But you may have a hard time following me this morning, because I had a hard time pulling things together. The original talk title was Honoring Our Survival Adaptations. Before we can be transformed, we must first survive. So my ministerial mind went off on a tangent to say, you know, that applies to the environment as well. So see if you can follow those two strains through this sermon. I was thinking in terms that we all develop coping mechanisms and survival strategies in life. All of these are, to a greater or lesser extent, the result of threats to our physical or mental health and or our need to focus on our own welfare. To put it another way, in order to survive, we develop some bad habits. My personal coping mechanism, and one that I get reminded of frequently, is to throw myself into my work, sometimes to the detriment of other relationships and activities. I know intellectually that that's an attempt to overcompensate for my need for acceptance, which goes back to a childhood story. But other mechanisms of coping might include drugs or alcohol or food that we use to numb our feelings. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is an extreme coping mechanism that our bodies and our brains can invoke in a futile attempt and sometimes disastrous attempt to protect us from further harm. On the other end of the spectrum are all the ways that we turn a blind eye to societal issues like mental health, systemic poverty, or the history of relations with our indigenous peoples of this land. All of those are things that touch us deeply, but all of us have to find a way to cope with living in the world and living with that reality. In order to survive and preserve our mental and physical health, we find ways to cope. And these coping mechanisms are nothing to be ashamed of. They're necessary and they're inevitable. But that said, we need to gently recognize them, address them if we're going to grow spiritually. But you can only address those issues when your basic needs for survival and security have been met. There's a parallel with the environmental problems of the world in our nation and in our nation today. In order to survive, we cut down those trees. We cut down the old growth forests. We fished the cod stocks to the brink of extinction. We wiped the buffalo from the plains, and we allowed coal mines to operate in very unsafe conditions, and on and on. We've exploited the oil sands of Alberta and Saskatchewan with little thought to the consequences other than the creation of jobs and our economic survival. And just as we must do with our personal coping mechanisms, we need to gently recognize these coping mechanisms and address them if we're going to avoid the most dramatic environmental consequences for our planet and for our species. So has anybody heard about the Kinder Morgan pipeline?
I'm not sure.
Too much.
Well, that's very much on my mind this morning, and it has been for quite a while. The confrontation over that Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion makes a great case study on how we can respond unrealistically when we reject our own coping mechanisms, if we go to extremes. The rejection of what was just a couple of decades ago an economic jewel, a matter of Canadian pride and self-sufficiency. We've turned on the oil sands with righteous moral indignation, and this creates a challenge for Unitarian Universalist ministers like myself. For those of you who don't know, I spent most of my life before I became minister managing one of those factories that was taking those couple of trees, turning them into something else. And I made vinyl chloride, which is a carcinogenic material that you have to handle very carefully. I made automobile tires, I made industrial batteries with lead and acid. All to make our lives easier, all to provide us with things that we needed. So over the past few weeks, there's been a nonstop stream of emails, mostly condemning Kinder Morgan Pipeline, on the Canadian Unitarian Council's leadership Google group listserv. The lone voice expressing concern that all you use are not opposed to the Kinder Morgan has been the voice of Brian Kiley. Not surprisingly, the minister of the Unitarian Church in Edmonton, Alberta. Problems are that oil extracted from the oil sand requires the release of more carbon dioxide than do other sources of petroleum. And the nature of the oil produced is more difficult to clean up in the event of a spill into a body of water. And given the crisis in global warming by carbon dioxide emissions and the inherent risks of a spill from a pipeline or a tanker, isn't this just a no-brainer? Isn't it obvious that we should stop the Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion? Doesn't this cause call for righteous indignation? Shouldn't all our UU ministers from across Canada be making their way to the barricades in Burnaby? I have to confess that I'm conflicted. I have no plans to man the barricades in Burnaby at this point. And how can a minister in good conscience not be opposed to this pipeline expansion? I recognize that the oil sands continue to be an important source of employment and wealth generation for this country. a survival mechanism, if you will, that we are in the process of outgrowing. In the past few years, proposals for at least three other pipelines, Energy East, Northern Gateway, and the XL extension, have been stopped in their tracks. I don't know the exact status of the XL extension, but the other two have been dead issues. So that left one pipeline. The Kinder Morgan expansion is being proposed on the same right-of-way of an existing pipeline, a line that's been in use since 1953. That surprised me when I looked it up. It's been in continuous use since 1953. I looked up the history of spills. There's been, as far near as I can tell, there's been no spills on the pipeline itself. At the terminus, there's been spills of a few hundred cubic meters of oil. Most cases, it's been contained. The project to twin this pipeline was proposed in good faith by companies involved, and they followed our established processes to get approvals. Well, there's no doubt carbon dioxide emissions are a critical problem, and they need to be addressed in a systematic way. In my opinion, we won't have an impact on global warming by trying to stop legitimate oil production or transportation projects one at a time. Actually, the amount of oil that will go through the Kinder Morgan pipeline as a percentage of what's being produced in the tar sands is not terribly significant, and the oil will find another way to market, probably a more dangerous one. So there's a recent book out. I just managed to get a copy, and it's going to take me a while to read it. But Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, and Humanism, and Progress. Steven Pinker is an inveterate optimist, I think fairly realistic optimist. And he takes an optimistic view on the prospects for the improvement of environmental conditions around the world, in general, the human condition around the world, and he backs up those arguments with statistics. As I say, I haven't been able to read most of the book yet, but I did look at in detail at the section on the environmental on the environment in preparation for this sermon. Steven Pinker makes the case that environmental conditions have improved around the world as countries get wealthier. The biggest environmental problems are in the poorest countries of the world. Environmental control, in a way, is a luxury. And that luxury is dealt with after a people have a sense of financial security. And so the continued growth of the economy and the creation of employment is crucial to these continued advances. So I digress here for a moment. I managed battery factories dealing with lead and sulfuric acid. And in particular, I managed a very old one in Fort Erie, Ontario. A very dirty one and a very difficult one. And we dealt with changes in the environment, in the laws around working with lead and lead emissions and sulfuric acid emissions. And there were times when I thought there's no way that we can stay in business, no way we can do what we're doing and meet these requirements. But because the company was making a profit, we were able to meet those requirements. And eventually that plant closed, and that was the right thing to do. That plant was sort of beyond what could be done. But the newer plants that I went to in Columbus, Georgia, when I moved to the United States, had been built to much higher standards. And even while I was there, I saw dramatic changes that are possible. But only if you're generating the wealth to make those kinds of improvements. So Pinker goes on, and this is kind of what I'm getting at, I guess. He makes the point that we learn from our mistakes. So I mentioned that the pipeline itself has a pretty good history, as near as I can tell, in BC. The issue is that when the oil gets to tidewater, it then has to leave in tankers, and they have to make their way through the Strait of Juan de Fuca, among other hazardous bits of water. But for the sake of argument, now, his book is filled with graphs and charts and data and statistics. So I just wanted to show you one that I found.
For those who want to have an optimistic view of the world, this is a graph showing the heavier black line shows the amount of oil spilled from 1970 to 2015 from tankers. And the lighter line going up to the right is the amount of oil that's being shipped by sea. And you can see how greatly that's reduced. And that happened,
and I know I'm grossly simplifying things here, but it happened because of investments in newer ships, in newer technologies. I got to believe that the GPS system for global positioning for tankers, the quality of the maps and charts that are available for navigation, the terrible lessons that had to be learned after Exxon Valdez and other wrecks, that companies had to change the way they were operating, and we're making progress. So when you're making progress, suddenly say, now's the time to stop. You know, we can't do this anymore. We can't take that risk anymore, is, I think, a little bit like the Lorax. It's a little bit of an oversimplification. So Steven Pinker's book is filled with graphs that show the improvement in human condition, not just environmentally, but in all aspects of human life. And I just wanted to include that one example because it related to Kinder Morgan. Incidentally, one of my colleagues down the street, I meet every Wednesday with a group of ministers, and I may have told you this, I'm sure I told you this before, but you probably don't remember it anyway, so I'll tell you again. He's a very well-known minister in Halifax, and his opinion is that we are going to hit the wall environmentally, that things are getting so bad that we're about to have some kind of a calamitous collapse of the environmental systems in the world. And I took him to task over that, and I took all of my Christian colleagues to task over that, to say that comes from 2,000 years of Christian teaching about the end of the world, that the end of the world is coming. The only way to get out of this, there's going to be some dramatic change. The kingdom of God is at hand, and that's what's going to save us. It certainly isn't based on the statistics and on the data. All the people that look at that say, things are getting better. The human species is learning amazing things about how to manage difficult situations and do them safely. The number of people killed in natural disasters, I didn't show you that chart, but that's plummeted. It's gone. It's incredible how much that's come down. Because we build buildings safer now, because we can predict storms, because we can evacuate people, because we have all these skills and abilities. So I know this is kind of counter to the story of the Lorax. I'm going to have to write another children's story. Maybe over the summer, come back in the fall. Not that the story of the Lorax isn't important, but it's one piece of a very complex puzzle. The one thing that Steven Pinker doesn't mince words about is global warming and CO2 emissions and how difficult that problem is going to be to come to grips with. And he doesn't talk about the Kinder Morgan pipeline, but I think if he was, he would be saying what I'm saying. We're not going to solve that problem by picketing one pipeline at a time. That's not going to solve the problem. His first recommendation is the implementation of carbon taxes, which is happening around the world now. Surprisingly, I think with less pushback than I would have expected, carbon taxes in BC, carbon taxes in Ontario. So that would be his first approach. And see, that's a systematic change that happens across the board that allows companies to make decisions and work within some kind of a framework without thinking that they're going to have a project stopped because a bunch of people, Unitarian ministers, showed up and protested at their gates. I wanted to read you a little bit, just because it's a little bit humorous and it's a little bit light, so don't take it too seriously. But he's making a point here. A point about righteousness, righteous indignation. Another common sentiment about how to prevent climate change is expressed in this letter of a kind that I receive every now and again. So I don't think this is an actual letter. I think this is a semblance of letters. Dear Professor Pinker, we need to do something about global warming. Why don't the Nobel Prize-winning scientists sign a petition? Why don't they tell the blunt truth that the politicians are pigs and don't care how many people get killed in floods and droughts? Why don't you and some friends start a movement on the internet to get people to sign a pledge that they will make real sacrifices to fight global warming? Because that's the problem. Nobody wants to make any sacrifices. People should pledge to never fly on airplanes except in dire emergencies because airplanes burn so much fuel. People should pledge to eat no meat, or at least no meat 3 days a week, because meat production adds so much carbon to the atmosphere. People should pledge to buy no jewelry, ever, because refining gold and silver is so energy intensive. We should abolish artistic pottery, because it burns so much carbon. The potters in university art departments are just going to have to accept the fact that we can't go on like this. Well, he brings up this ingenious suggestion to illustrate two psychological impediments that we face in dealing with climate change. First is cognitive. Can people really grasp what it means when we're talking about millions of tons of CO2 emissions? What percentage of the CO2 problem is really related to aircraft? What's related to potters firing their kilns? People sometimes aren't able to make those judgments. But the other important impediment is moralistic. The human moral sense is not particularly moral. It encourages dehumanization. Politicians are pigs. And punitive aggression. Make the polluters pay. And also by conflating profligacy with evil and asceticism with virtue. The moral sense can sanctify pointless displays of sacrifice. In many cultures, people flaunt their righteousness with vows of fasting, chastity, self-abnegation, bonfires of the vanities, and animal or sometimes human sacrifices. Even in modern societies, according to studies that he has done, people esteem others according to how much time or money they forfeit in their altruistic acts together than by how much good they actually accomplish. Manning the barricades in Burnaby is much easier to do than effectively lobbying for increased taxes or satisfying the desire to vent righteous indignation and moral leadership. Steven Pinker argues, and I tend to agree with him, that the best hope to curb climate change is a tax on CO2 emissions and this is really unpopular, the implementation of nuclear technology for the generation of electricity. Holding rallies and preaching benefits of increased taxes and incentives for nuclear power don't have the cachet of getting arrested at a pipeline construction site. I feel for my colleagues in British Columbia and Alberta. They're being called to take a public stand on these matters. I have the luxury of distance from that particular site. On May the 1st, there is actually a Unitarian service going to be held in Burnaby Mountain in relation to the pipeline. And I don't envy my colleagues because from what I've seen, they're going to try and walk both sides of the argument. You know, it could be this and this, and we're all people of goodwill and we need to learn to work together. That actually is the message of Unitarian Universalism. We have no theology opposed to pipelines. That's not in our dogma or creed. And we need to work together to resolve these problems. But it's not flashy and it's hard to get your feet of righteous indignation if that's what you want. Well, we wade into economic and complicated environmental issues with very little guiding theology beyond our personal understanding and our instincts. I suppose some might conclude that my decision to avoid joining the campaign against Kinder Morgan is just another coping mechanism, a way to avoid the real issues that are involved. It's my good fortune that you ministers are allowed to be human and to claim no divine insight and to have to resort to coping mechanisms from time to time. I can assure you that I'll continue to wrestle with this issue, and sometimes that's all that we can do with our coping mechanisms. May it be so, and amen.